It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in now on family businesses that are an important engine of the Wisconsin economy. The resource platform Family Business estimates roughly two-thirds of all American workers are employed at family firms. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nathan Brinkman is founder, CEO, and president of Triumph Wealth Management based in Madison. Nathan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you.
Good morning. Yes,
good Jennifer. Morning.
Good morning. Jennifer Pendergast here as well, adjunct professor at the John L. Ward Center for Family Enterprises at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Jennifer, welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Jennifer, let's start with you. You've made a career of studying and consulting with family-owned businesses. People might imagine small stores, family-run restaurants. What is the reality of the size and scope of family-run enterprises?
Well, they actually run the gamut, and the piece that you're saying people imagine is definitely true, and actually the backbone of our economy and great employers and people and contributors to communities. But, you know, there are also people around you like S.C. Johnson and Kohler Companies and Cargill, and those get to be some of the largest companies in the country and employ thousands and thousands of people and have been contributing to the economy for hundreds of years.
So really, they run the gamut. I was struck by your research that says we view family firms as very, very trustworthy. What are the perceptions like of family-run businesses?
Well, it's interesting. So Edelman is a well-recognized PR firm, and they do a trust barometer every year. And occasionally, they pick a target population to focus in on. A few years ago, they looked at family-owned businesses and found that, in general, they are more trusted by their employees to do what they say. They have more trust in the leadership of those companies. My sense is that stems from the fact, a couple of things. One, if I have a vested interest in my company staying around for a long time, which a lot of families will say we're committed to running this for the long term, then I'm incented to do the right thing because I don't get to walk away from what I'm doing. Also, family-owned businesses are often the backbone of their community, their employers there. So the same people that own that business are sending their kids to school in the same schools and going to, you know, the same religious affiliations and in the same clubs and organizations. And so they have a vested interest to be, you know, they're recognized as people that people can see walking around the street. So they want to make sure they do the right thing. And then there's just a certain pride, I think, in a lot of these families in building quality products and providing good services and being good employers. And so that results in them, you know, I think that level of trust that you see.
Really having that sense of place. Nathan, you own a family company, work with a lot of family-owned businesses. What challenges are companies facing?
Well, it's like many other businesses out there. Families, during times of COVID, struggle with taking care of just their internal families. And then as a business owner, you're taking care of your business family as well. And so we've seen a lot of stress placed onto family business owners of taking care, if you will, of their internal families as well as their external business families. So that is something I think that's really arisen here in the last 3 years as these owners are trying to navigate through the changing times. And secondly, I would say, obviously, recently with the change of interest rates, these are generally closely held companies. And so just adjusting to the changing economic environment has been very significant as well. And as Jennifer said, many of these business owners are, we'll call them first responders to a community. They identify the needs inside of these communities. To be good people and good employers to reflect the values of the family, but also to their communities. And I think that's really important if we think about or look around what's going on in our local communities as well as the world.
First responders to a community. Nathan Brinkman there, founder and CEO of Triumph Wealth Management in Madison. Jennifer Pendergast is an adjunct professor at Northwestern University. As we talk about family businesses and get insights on them, you can join in the conversation, call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Jennifer, how do family-owned businesses compare to publicly traded companies in terms of success and returns and size?
So because they don't have access to capital, as Nathan said, you know, they're reliant on either bank capital or internally generated capital, family businesses tend to be smaller than a lot of publicly held companies. They also tend to maybe grow at a more measured pace. If you want to last forever, you don't take big risks, right? So I don't take big loans from the bank because I might not be able to pay them off. I may not make an acquisition that I don't think, you know, I can run successfully. So they tend to be a lot more steady in their returns and a lot more resilient to downturns that maybe not grow as quickly on the upside. So that's kind of how they would look financially. One of the things that I have a chip on my shoulder about, or a pet peeve, being a big advocate and supporter of family businesses, is there's a lot of research that's cited that says that a third of family businesses don't succeed to the second generation, and then only a third of those that succeeded to the second succeed to the third. So that gives you about 10% of them by the third generation. And while that data is out there, what it doesn't do is compare family-owned businesses to non-family-owned businesses. And if you look at data around the length of time that a company lasts in the Standard & Poor's 500 index, as an example, that number has dropped incredibly over the past 50 years. And so I don't think that the tenure, the duration of family businesses is any shorter than public companies. I think in many cases it's longer. I can't think of a publicly traded company CEO that would sit in front of shareholders and say, my goal is for this business to last forever. But many family businesses will say, our aspiration is that we will be a privately held family-run company for as long as possible. And what that means is we have to be flexible and adjust to changes. Maybe we need to change what businesses we're in. Cargill is not in the same businesses that Cargill was in, you know, when they started, nor is Kohler, nor a lot of these big businesses, but they've learned how to adjust and adapt so that they can be resilient over the long term. And so I think the returns over time can be higher, but they're definitely more resilient.
And we're going to put a pin in succession. We're going to definitely go there. But Nathan, you know, these businesses can be complicated. There's the family. There's the actual business. There might be other ownership. What advantages or disadvantages do family businesses have over other ownership models?
Well, I would say the first one would be reflection of values. As Jennifer was stating, you know, families are incredibly intimate, and generally you see core values transferred from generation to generation, and we see that inside of businesses as well. I was recently at a presentation by Helen Johnson Leopold, and she talked about how Sam Johnson, as he was turning the tide of SC Johnson, sat down with the family first and really enforce those core values. And when you see that, as Jennifer was stating, that resonates throughout an industry. It resonates throughout a business or a corporation. So we see them as being really resilient and reflecting core values. That's also evident in companies like Menards, which is a Wisconsin-based, closely held business by a family. We see that locally with Epic, in Madison, where incredible leaders who are leading forward based on their core principles, their core values, which, not to say that doesn't exist in publicly held companies. However, we just see it so much more reinforced and intimately held within family business.
Nathan Brinkman, founder of Triumph Wealth Management in Madison. Jennifer Pendergast is an adjunct professor of family enterprises at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. As we discuss businesses owned and controlled by families, you can call in with a question, share your perspectives, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Family-owned businesses, they contribute greatly to Wisconsin's economy, but they face unique challenges. According to the Wisconsin Family Business Center, there's space to talk. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nathan Brinkman is founder and CEO of an investment and financial planning firm in Madison. Jennifer Pendergast is a family enterprise consultant at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. The North America Family Business Report from Brightstar Capital Partners, it found more than 60% of family-owned companies, they don't have a formal succession plan. Why are there so many companies without plans for the next generation?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. It's not because they don't know it's important, I don't think. I mean, everybody realizes that you know, if you say you want to stay owned in the family for a long time, then you need to have a plan to pass it down. So I don't think it's being naive. I think it's that it's hard, and I'm sure Nathan can talk about some of this. But if you think about the alternative, I'm not in a family-owned business. I could be private or public, right? As I think about when do I want to retire and who do I want to replace me, it's hard enough to think about, am I ready to go? And particularly if you're a founder generation of a business, often very hard to let go of something that they've worked so hard to create, right? Mm. So there's that own personal piece. But in the end of the day, if it's not my family, I think through, okay, do I have anyone in this company behind me that I think could run this? And if so, how do I make sure they're prepared? If not, should I be looking for someone outside the business? Or, you know, maybe this business needs to be sold or transitioned to someone else, right? But if it's in my family, oftentimes the presumption of succession is that it would go to a family member. And then that becomes really complicated, because if I have more than one child in the business, or if I'm not sure my child is going to be successful at this, or if I don't want to saddle them with the stress of running a company where their siblings may be co-owners in that business with them, there's just a lot of complexity there. I also see with the MBA students that I teach at Kellogg School of Management, you know, that they have new ideas and they're excited to come into the business and try new and different things. And oftentimes there's a resistance of that from elder generations who want to continue to do things the way that they've been doing them in the past, or feel like they have the benefit of having seen what succeeded and failed in the past, and that maybe the next generation coming in, while energetic, could be a bit naive. So you can often have tension about what direction you want to take a business in. So for a lot of these reasons, I think people avoid the difficult conversations around how they're going to pass down the business, because they're afraid that they don't have someone capable, or that they don't have alignment among the current generation and the next generation around how the business should be run.
They're so sensitive because it not only involves the direction and the philosophy of the business, but it also gets into personalities. It's very much a human decision as well.
Well, and on top of that, I wanted to go back to something that I think is very important that Nathan was saying before. You know, the level of stress that is put on someone when there's no distinction between your sort of family and home life and your business life, they all become blended into one system, right? And mm-hmm. so if I make someone unhappy, if I choose one child over another, or I tell my children I don't think they're qualified to run this business, I still have Thanksgiving with them. Mm-hmm. I still have, you know, they may still even live under my roof. How are their, you know, if I have grown children with spouses, how is that spouse going to take the news about, you know, who I've chosen to be my successor? So So there's a lot of emotional complexity that comes into this that can make it really challenging.
Nathan, you help companies create succession plans. What does that process look like?
It's messy.
In a word.
And that's kind of one of our pitch lines is, you know, we're at that intersection of messiness. And to kind of backpack on what Jennifer said, you know, a lot of these intimately closely held businesses, 85% of their net worth is concentrated in one asset. It's their business. And so when you think about the unwinding phase, it's not like you just walk away with a 401k or a retirement plan into retirement. You also have to figure out what to do with your largest asset. And two is really understanding the value of that asset. And we're watching that being played out in a family business in the courts today. But many business owners truly do not know the real value of their business. They take a guess at it. And therefore, internally within their family, they have what we call a wealth gap. Do I have enough to confidently walk into retirement? And then we have what we call a value gap in the business. Do we truly understand what the value of that business is? And sometimes we focus on the third element, which is what we call the profit gap. What could or should it be worth in order to transfer? And so as we look at these things, it's really, that's the messiness or the complexities that Jennifer was saying is not only the human side, but really just the financial side of if this is a high concentration of my wealth, how do I unwind this so that I get enough and yet don't really squeeze the company too much financially so they can survive throughout generations as well. And so it's messy, it's complex, and it requires a lot of expertise. And my last point I'll throw into this part of the segment is, this is where owners have to surround themselves with a group of experts. To think that you're going to pick up all these skills suddenly and work through this process and do it once. Most of these business owners sell their business once. And to think that you're going to do it perfectly the first time in such an incredibly important topic, I really encourage owners to think through that and give themselves ample time to assemble the right team and get yourself educated so that you can confidently run your business and keep it going without trying to be the expert in everything.
Nathan Brinkman from Triumph Wealth Management in Madison, a family-owned business, and Jennifer Pendergast from Northwestern University. As we look at family firms here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, challenges and opportunities, you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Jennifer, what is the role of like boards of directors who are a little bit more removed maybe than the CEO and the other C-suite offices in terms of succession and what that thinking is like?
Great question. First of all, let me sort of pound the drum for the notion of a board as a great tool and a resource in a family business. And I think even in earlier stage family businesses, oftentimes a founder would say, well, I don't want to listen to or need to listen to someone because I own all of this company and I know how to run it. But I think of it as, you know, at the very least, this kitchen cabinet of smart people who are well-intended and want to help you achieve your dream of sustaining this business across generations. So who wouldn't want a group of people like that to be a sounding board and help them? They can be really useful in a time of succession because of your point about being a little bit more removed. There's an objectivity that they can bring if the retiring generation is willing to listen to them around the qualifications and capabilities of the potential next leaders. If they feel a true sort of fiduciary sense of responsibility to the company, they can also be the ones that are thinking about the risk of making sure that there's good financial planning in place so that the owner is prepared to be able to step down. They can be looking at making sure that there's good support systems in place for any next generation leaders, so that they have good people around them. I don't want to discount also the fact in succession that, you know, when you're talking about leadership succession in a family business, every one of the employees is watching and wondering what's going to happen. And so one of the big risks is, if they don't feel like this business is going to be in good hands, do I want to stay in a place where, you know, yes, it's great to be in this family-owned business environment, but what if there's not adequate planning? And so I worry the business is going to have to be sold because the founder hasn't put, you know, either financial plans in place or a succession plan. All of a sudden, I'm not going to be working at the place I thought I was before. Or what if I'm not feeling good about the caliber of the next leader that's going to come in, or they're going to take the business in a very different direction, or they're not going to care as much as the current owner.
And that create uncertainty. I want to pause right there with Jennifer Pendergast, family business consultant at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, Nathan Brinkman, founder of a financial planning and investing advisory. You can join in. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. From beloved family-run restaurants to giant global manufacturers that have their roots in Wisconsin, think SC Johnson & Son, Kohler. We examine the dynamics of family-run firms and how they're changing. Call in with a question you can share at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nathan Brinkman is founder and CEO of Triumph Wealth Management in Madison. Jennifer Pendergast is here, teaches at the John L. Ward Center for Family Enterprises at Northwestern University. And Dan Hartung founded the agribusiness firm Hartung Brothers with his twin brother when he was 17 years old. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
Good morning. Tell us about Hartung Brothers and how you and your brother founded this company.
Well, we obviously started it a long time ago. it'll be 50 years here in January 25. So it's been an interesting ride for sure. But we got started farming just commercial crops, and then got into seed production in the Madison area, and then got into vegetable production in the mid-80s, and that really took us pretty much all over the country. And we added some additional, we're also in the fertilizer business for about 12 years, 15 years, I guess. And so just gradually grew as people needed additional services. We just grew the business, and now we operate in, so I think five states, and Hawaii, plus with Hawaii, and also in Ontario. We do a lot of cucumber production in Ontario between Detroit and Niagara Falls.
Mm. Sounds like your company kept looking to meet needs, evolving, maybe at times reinventing itself. Is that fair?
I would say that's fair. We've made all of our, I guess, moves and made all of our money on doing things other people don't want to do. And that could be a food processor that doesn't want to be involved in the egg side but still needs the raw product to run their plant, a seed producer that has a certain need that with our irrigated production could solve. So pretty much that's how we've grown the business.
And along the way, Hartung Brothers grew to include all of your siblings. Did you set out to keep it as a family company?
I think so. I mean, it wasn't, I guess it wasn't, absolute. Everybody had to join in. My parents were both involved in other businesses. My dad managed a large farm co-op in Cottage Grove for 35 years, and my mom was in the Amway business for probably 40 years. And so they, they're both excellent mentors. They were never involved, day to day in the business, but certainly taught us well along the way, and were great examples.
Over the decades, how have you gone about resolving differences in the family business? Differences in what markets to enter, differences in what services to offer. How do you negotiate that?
That's really never been much of an issue for us. If it was a good opportunity, and again, it's got to be presented well, and not everything we do is good. So you know, we're not adverse to failure, we've done a number of things that have not worked out. But we learn and we move on, we've been successful, so I think that's, you know, it's always easier if you're successful at things. It'll cloud out the failures, or at least hopefully you got more successful things than failures. So at this point, it looks we certainly have had that, but you know, they do staying, but nobody ever gets, I guess, at any of our board meetings, no one's saying, why didn't we do it, or why we did that, or shouldn't have done it. Very, very, I mean, we discuss things thoroughly, and then once it's decided, then we're all in.
Hmm. Jennifer, is Dan's story typical for how family companies are formed?
I think so. You know, a couple of things I heard. One, he said, I guess we started thinking this way, that we wanted it to be family-owned. I mean, I think in the beginning, and I can't speak for him, but generally people are just trying to make sure they get a business off the ground, right? Mm-hmm. So this is something we're trying to do. We're thinking about day-to-day. The focus is very much operationally making the business work and adjusting as needed. The other piece I love about the story is, you know, over time, what business you're in evolves. To meet your needs as well as to meet, you know, the needs of being successful. And, you know, one of the things I had mentioned earlier was that, you know, rarely is a business that's been around, you know, for 50 years or 100 years or more than that, doing what they did, you know, in the same business, making the same things that they started out doing. So the key is the flexibility to evolve with the times, to be able to, you know, adjust to what the family is capable of doing and willing to take on, but also, you know, the world changes around you, so that flexibility to be able to adapt is really important.
Dan, I understand your twin brother recently retired. What are your plans for the company as you and your siblings look toward retirement?
Well, we're in the process of looking at how do you, you know, I guess that very issue is, you know, we're in the midst of it right now with trying to transition these various departments over to non-family member leaders and managers. Nobody has any desire to really to sell their stock or to get out of the business at this time. So I don't, continue on and try to do it with non-family management, of which a lot of our departments are already managed that way. So it's now getting to be, you know, get the guys further up, whether it be the, you know, in vice president positions. Eventually, we'll be, you know, we'll have to get my successor. I'm not planning on going anywhere anytime real soon. So at this point, I'm more focused on getting these other positions so they're well, you know, not only the guy's in that position, but he's had a couple of years in it so that we really know we've got the right guy.
Nathan, what comes up for you as you hear Dan's story?
Well, it's just a reflection of, you know, what he didn't say is the humility and humbleness of if you like pickles, you've for sure had one of the cucumbers that's been pickled by our Tung brothers. So they have a vast network as well as in the corn and egg industry. And going back to mom and dad being supportive and helpful, even though they weren't right in the business, it's very rare to have a family, and Dan didn't really mention how many are there, but he's got a number of siblings that have been involved in that business, and yet they still get together for things like Thanksgiving and Christmas, and it's really about the family values that that have been bestowed upon that family. And I'll specifically call out his mom, Lorna. When he said Amway, she was an incredibly entrepreneurial spirit, of which resonated down to the next generation. And likely will go to the third generation as well. So I just think of, again, the messiness we talked about. What happens, when you have a twin brother that retires and yet Dan is still raring to go and stay in that helm every day and doesn't plan on changing. And that goes back to the sophistication of everything is not equal and fair. It just has to be planned around.
We're talking about the role of family businesses in the economy, and especially here in Wisconsin. Nathan Brinkman, founder and CEO of Triumph Wealth Management. Dan Hartung is co-founder of Hartung Brothers Agriculture Company. And Jennifer Pendergast is from Northwestern University and works as a consultant to family-run businesses. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer, what should people consider before going to work for a family-owned business?
First of all, I think that we can't put all family-owned businesses in one bucket, right? Just like any business. So I think I would want to understand what's the family's role in the business. How connected are they to it? Is it something that they want to be in for the long term? A lot of families are very good about being very vocal about their values and how those play into the business and the history. I'd love to see, if I were going to work somewhere, that there's a pride in the family. I'd want to know how connected the owners are to the business and how committed they are to the business. I think those things are, important if you're worried about, committing a long-term career. I'd want to see a certain level of professionalism in managing the challenges that can happen in a family business. So I had mentioned before, would love to see, that there's a strong board of directors or an advisory board. I would want to know that there's something that families frequently put in place around, rules that govern the family's ability to be employed in the business. So can any family member come into the business, or do they need to meet the same requirements as anyone coming in from the outside? That's something that I would want to look at as well. And so I think a lot of those things, it's always telling to me how vocal or outspoken families are about some of these things, about their pride in the business. Do they give back to their communities? Do they talk about their origin stories and their founders and the values that those brought to the business? Are they making an effort to be well organized as a family? Does the family get along with each other, or is there dissension among the family members? Those are things that are going to be a little bit harder to tell. So you may have to ask other employees about them. They're not going to show up at first blush, but I'd want to see that the best of a family business, which is the strengths around values and commitment, are there, and the potential worse of, which is, lack of family cohesion, maybe conflict in the family, isn't present.
Dan, how do you create boundaries, like at the Thanksgiving table? Is it like no talking about work, or does it matter? Is everyone pretty easygoing? What is that like in terms of work and family?
Well, from the start, We set it up that we're I guess, how do you want to say this? We didn't set it up that you're automatically in the business, I guess. So if one of my brothers or sisters would pass away, or their stock would be bought back by the business, we wouldn't automatically go to the family. And that was kind of everybody wanted to be able to pick their partner. Okay, so I've got six brothers and two sisters in the business, and a brother-in-law that are all shareholders, but we all knowingly had these people come into the business, and we did not want to have it set up. It wasn't heir to you or whatever. That's the way we set things up. But we truly run it. We really try to be, cognizant of the fact that it's a business, and we run the business, and our personal lives are our personal lives, but we certainly all get along real well, so that's always a big help. But And I would say from a disagreement standpoint, we just don't have a lot of them because nobody, you know, really comes up with, if it's a bad idea, they smoke it out themselves, usually. And I mean, there's always, you know, when we're looking at distributions, you know, some people want more, some people want less. There's reasons for both, and you ultimately put it to a vote. I don't think we've had more than one vote in 48 years. It was not unanimous.
Mm.
Once the discussion got done and the reasoning got put on the table.
Dan Hartung is founder of a Madison-based agribusiness firm with his twin brother. Nathan Brinkman, founder of a wealth management and financial advisory firm in Madison. And Jennifer Pendergast consults with family enterprises, researches this aspect of the economy at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We focus on family-owned businesses and learn about their challenges and their future in Wisconsin and beyond. Call in with a question. Share what's on your mind at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nathan Brinkman and Dan Hartung run family firms. Jennifer Pendergast is here, consults on and researches these businesses and is an adjunct professor at Northwestern University. Let's bring in Michael in Superior. Michael, hi. What is your situation?
Hi. I have a little four-year-old son, and I own a business relatively young. What's a good way to get him involved in the business? Because I want to leave it to him one day. I know if you push him too hard, he might pull away. And if you don't get him involved enough, he might not be interested. What's a good way to get him involved?
Michael, thank you for that question. Jennifer, how do you walk that line?
Well, first of all, I commend you for thinking about this early on. There's research that suggests that passing on an entrepreneurial spirit in families occurs early. So it's literally the simple stuff like the take your kid to work. And when I ask family businesses the stories of their first memories, they're often sitting in the office, going to work with dad, getting to ride it along in the truck if it's on a route, or getting to see some of the business firsthand. I was recently in the office of a business owning family where now it's going to the fourth generation, that they had actually like toys sitting in the office for the kids to come play and sit when their grandpa went to work. I remember talking to a business-owning family that makes cosmetic products, and they said during COVID, their kids came to the office because they were making hand sanitizer to help in the COVID efforts, and the kids actually thought that what their mom and dad did was stir the vats of the stuff that they were making. And so maybe the kids don't get exactly what you do, but this excitement of, hey, this is what we do, or driving down the street, you know, that's something that, you know, that we're involved with somehow. I think you can create this pride in what you do. So even just giving them exposure to the little things, you know, things that may be kid friendly, that they could be involved with. I do think there is a definite concern about putting too much burden or expectation on them. So I think sending the message that, you know, I would love for you to be here someday, but the business can also be a means to an end, which is if we do it successfully, you know, we generate money that you can use to pursue something that you're passionate about too. So they don't feel sort of an obligation or a fear that they're going to let a parent down. Mm. The other thing, just as a quick aside, I would say is, you know, oftentimes, you know, any job is stressful, but being the owner of something is very stressful, right? Because other people are depending on you for employment. And if your job doesn't work out, you can't just necessarily go to the next place, right? So being very careful about editing yourself, about what you're saying around your spouse or friends, about maybe frustrations that you bring home from work, you have to be a little bit careful around kids. And then the other thing is making sure that you still make time for family. If they see the business as this sort of the most important child of the family or something that doesn't allow you the flexibility to have time with them, I think it can be something that they resent over time. So making sure that you're still making space for family so they view this as a positive thing, not something that's taking you away from them.
Michael, thank you so much for the call. Nathan, this is personal. What is the succession plan for your own company? What can you share?
Michael's question resonates with me. I remember as a young child, my parents owned an office product store and I counted pencils and our reward was pizza. And when I graduated from college, my grandfather, who was a farmer, family-owned business, said I was a lucky kid because I got to work half days. I just got to pick which 12 hours. So out of my three children, one of them is interested, in fact, is licensed in the securities industry, and is my rule was they have to go work somewhere for 2 to 3 years because I'm a great coach, but I'm a terrible trainer. So she's getting training right now at a different organization. But my advice, Michael, is this, is make it fun. There are times in every business that are rough spots. I've been a student and a steward of this process for a long time. I won't go through all the credentials, but just for 20 years, I've been studying this. And one of the things that resonated with me many years ago was just to share life with our kids. And two of my children have no interest. They didn't like the ups and downs, and they didn't like the gyrations of what happens. But my daughter happened to click onto it. But we were very transparent with her when times were good, when times were bad, good days, bad days. But most important, just to make it fun and to communicate with them of, this is my passion. This is something that I care intimately and deeply about. And I think your kids pick up on that. If it's just a job, they'll pick up on that as well. And then my last piece of advice is take care of yourself financially. So in order to successfully transfer a business, you have to be able to afford to do that. And so I've been planning around that for a long time, just so I'm not dependent on my business or the value of that business necessarily to enjoy, my last stage of life here in retirement.
And Dan Hartung, you have the last word here. Advice on those kiddos who are coming up behind you and the grandchildren in our 15, 20 seconds. Any advice there?
Well, we've got 80 some nieces and nephews
here,
so you really just got to let them choose. I mean, you can make it as pleasant or not, but certainly we have a lot of nieces and nephews will come out and spend time with their grandkids and so on. They go out and spend time with their.
They see pieces of it. Yes. Thank you all for joining us. Dan Hartung founded agribusiness firm Hartung Brothers at the age of 17. Jennifer Pendergast, adjunct professor at the John L. Ward Center for Family Enterprises at Northwestern University. And Nathan Brinkman, founder, CEO, and president of Triumph Wealth Management in Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a new collection of prose poems from Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman. Her works chronicle her childhood onset of obsessive-compulsive disorder and that journey into adulthood with an anxiety disorder causing repeated unwanted thoughts and fears. Be part of this conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cynthia Marie Hoffman's poetry collection is called Exploding Head. Cynthia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. So your collection is split into four sections. The first section is from the perspective of a child. Did any of these events you write about happen in your childhood, or are they artistic metaphors about your childhood?
Oh, this is such a funny question because actually my father read the poems just recently, last fall, when the advanced reading copy was out, and he said, well, I hope you imagined most of these things. I hope these are metaphors, but no, these are actually the thoughts that were going through my head at the time. It's quite scary to be a child with OCD when you have fears that come out of nowhere.
How did you, document those fears as a child? Did you just hold them through the years and then they come later in life pouring out through poetry as you become a poet? Or how did you hold on to these?
Exactly. I did hold on to them. I didn't tell anyone. And I think it was because a lot of the obsessions that can come with OCD aren't the types of things that it's okay to talk about generally in conversations. Fears of getting shot or fears that someone will break into your home, worrying constantly about being in a car accident. These things are just brushed off by others as don't worry about it. You know, it makes you feel like, especially when you're a child, you're the only one having these types of thoughts. No one else seems concerned. So there must be something wrong with me. And I decided that certainly if there was anything wrong with me, I was going to keep it secret. So I actually started writing about OCD when I was already about 35. And it was really the first time I had spoken more publicly, you know, with my poetry group around the dining room table in my own home, but to people that weren't my close family. And everything did sort of come spilling out through poetry. It gave me a way of speaking about things in an artistic platform that I had full control over, that space on the page. And it just felt like it was a way for me to express those things that I didn't have another outlet to express them in.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, did you feel any stigma or shame as you sat around your poetry circle at the table in talking about something so deeply personal as this anxiety disorder?
I think I worried that I would feel that way, but my poetry group was such a supportive group and collection of peers, and they really made me feel comfortable. When I first brought the poems, I said, I'm writing about something new, but I don't want to talk about what it is. I just want the poems to speak for themselves. I wasn't quite ready to say, I have OCD, this is OCD. I just wanted to show a bare, clean, non-labeled look inside my mind.
There are images and themes that come up through the collection, including an angel. What is the angel you write about?
The angel was actually a figure that appeared in my room when I was a little child. I'm not sure where he came from. Of course, I did go to Sunday school when I was a kid. I went to church. There was some religion in my house. So it obviously came from that. The idea of angels always fascinated me when I was little. I wanted to have an angel costume and dress up as an angel at Christmas. But this angel figure was not a guardian angel for me. It was something that was terrifying. And I just felt the presence of him standing there at night by my closet door. You know, as kids are afraid of things in the dark, I was afraid of an angel. And I had in my mind the idea that this angel, if I didn't cover my ear with the sheet at night, my ear was bare, the angel would approach my bed and lean over and whisper the secret of heaven. And I don't know why this was scary to me. And that's why I think that the angel got wrapped up in the idea of OCD for me. As I thought about what are my OCD symptoms, the angel seemed to be a part of that because there were these strange rules that were just there. They were associated with this angel. I had to cover my ear.
We're talking with Madison-based poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman, a new book of poetry. It's called Exploding Head. You can join in with questions and comments at any point, 800-642-1234. Cynthia, you establish a pattern of thought that you characterize as a game and rules. And in your poem, Conquerors, you write, you have your own game and you must play it quietly in your mind. And the rules are, if you don't count, you'll die. What did you mean by the game and the rules?
I guess it sounds a little bit like the childhood game of step on a crack and break your mother's back. OCD comes just assigned with these rules. If I do X, I'll be protected by Y. And so I think ultimately I was afraid of dying and still am. I want to live. I love my family. I love my life. I want to be alive and enjoy it. And so that's my biggest fear. It wraps up in everything. And OCD clamps itself onto whatever your biggest fear is, whatever you don't want to lose. And for me, I think just at a base level, that's my life. And I think that just the rules coming in quietly in my mind represented the idea that I had to keep it secret, that I didn't do anything really that was physically visible. Like I wasn't walking through a door 15 times to get out the door in the morning to school, things like that, that other people would notice. It was all internal, these mental compulsions to count and draw patterns on things, all in my head quietly.
You know, when I think of Conker, it's the British game using those little horse chestnut tree seeds and that idea of you strike the opponent's Conker and try to break it. Did you feel like there were these instances where things or people were striking out at you and trying to break you in some way?
I don't think so. I don't think others were trying to break me, but I think that it was the idea of breaking something open. I was fascinated by what's hidden inside. And you're right, Conkers is that British game. I lived in England when I was little, and my sister and I played Conkers. We loved it. It was so fun. And I kept the title in the book, even though I thought people might not know in the US what Conkers is. So I'm glad you know that game. And I think that it was just, the idea of holding so much inside and a fascination with how that might be eventually broken open.
Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman, new collection of poems. It's called Exploding Head, Navigating a Life with Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss a new collection of image-rich poems called Exploding Head that give a glimpse of what it's like to live with obsessive-compulsive disorder, which the National Institutes of Health characterizes as uncontrollably recurrent thoughts known as obsessions and repetitive behaviors referred to as compulsions. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. This is the fourth poetry collection by Cynthia Marie Hoffman of Madison. Let's bring in a call now, Jenny in Evansville. Jenny, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say how much I appreciate the topic. I was diagnosed with OCD when I was about 20, and I'm 50 years old now. So I guess I just want to underscore the fact that OCD is a very unique journey. It differs so much from person to person. Mine in particular manifested with germs. And today I'm very high functioning. I still very much live with it. It's just a part of me that I've come to accept. I'll have business meetings and be in all sorts of situations, and no one around me knows that I'm functioning with a certain set of rules. It's something that I don't hide it, but I also don't want it to be the focus. And so when I do confide in someone new and explain to them, I have this characteristic or this disorder, the first thing that they usually start doing is trying to accommodate for it. Oh, well, does this bother you? Does that bother you? And
how does that make you feel?
Actually, I'm the kind of person that I like to make the people around me feel at ease. And so I have learned to be very careful who I share that with. And it needs to be someone whom I can trust, so that I can say to them, look, I will let you know.
Yeah.
Please do not try. I think the hard thing is they have empathy and they want to try to accommodate. But what they don't understand, it is absolutely not rational. For example, I can drink out of a coffee mug in a restaurant, but I cannot drink out of a glass.
Jenny, I really appreciate you sharing your very personal journey with OCD. And Cynthia Marie Hoffman, what comes up as you hear Jenny's story?
Oh, thank you so much, Jenny, for sharing. All of that rung true for me, especially the loneliness when you're keeping something inside. And even if you aren't attempting to hide it or trying to not show your OCD, it's a very isolating disorder. And people who have OCD who have read my book say that the main thing that I think rang true for them was especially the childhood section, where it is just terribly lonely. And I don't think I even realized how alone I was until I wrote the book. I went back and I read it and I thought, I was terribly isolated. And it's only now that I'm starting to find a community of others in the OCD community and within the poetry community who have OCD, who are willing to support each other and say, yeah, that's exactly what it feels like for me. And that connection has been, for me, so powerful.
How did your life change after a firm diagnosis?
Actually, the idea of a firm diagnosis is a little fuzzy for me because since I kept everything so internal, and also because most of my compulsions and obsessions were mental and other people weren't necessarily recognizing it in me, no one brought me to therapy or identified it for me. I just knew something was wrong. And I don't know how, but somehow I ended up with a copy of Dr. Judith Rapoport's 1991 book, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing. And I think I was probably 16 and just driving at the time when that book fell into my hands. The very first case study in that book is about a man who worries that he might have run over someone with his car. And he's wondering, am I sure I didn't drive over someone with my car? I don't know. It's something about OCD causes you to lose your faith in your own memory and in your own experience. That's why sometimes we hear about people with OCD checking, did you turn off the stove? Checking, did you lock it? Because as soon as you do it, you think, did I really do that? And I had that very idea driving, you know, as a 16-year-old, did I really kill somebody? How do I know that I didn't? You know, there's this doubt. OCD has long been called the doubting disease. You know, and that's really what it is. So I knew all the things that I had been experiencing, those were OCD. That explained it for me. And I was just sure that I had this. And so I did a lot of self-help books over the years. And again, I think it was just the stigma and the secrecy that kept me from finding therapy. I did seek therapy for conditions that go along with OCD, like depression and anxiety. Cognitive behavioral therapy can be very helpful, but for OCD, it needs to be something specifically targeted, like a cognitive behavioral therapist who understands OCD, or exposure and response prevention therapy.
We're talking about a new poetry collection called Exploding Head. Madison-based poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman is here, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with the question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Stephen in Madison now. Stephen, hi.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, yeah. I would love to. So I'm someone that is more newly diagnosed with OCD. I found out recently from my psychiatrist it takes, on average, 17 years from onset of symptoms to diagnosis. For me, it was a big, oh, so that's what that is kind of moment. I still personally feel a little unequipped to write about it. And I'm wondering how it's affected your writing, and specifically if you feel like it gets in the way of your ability to write, or does it help in some way?
Thank you, Stephen. That's a great question. Cynthia?
That is a great question. By the way, this is Stephen Espada Dawson calling in. He is our Madison Poet Laureate.
Oh,
and
wow.
Also has OCD. Thank you so much, Stephen, for sharing that with us. I think OCD gets in the way of writing in the same way that it gets in the way of my life. I have this obsessive need to just read things over and over again after I've written them. And it's sad. I often think, how much could I have accomplished in my life if I didn't have to read this email I've already sent 5 or 10 or 15 more times after sending it? I could just send it and move on with my day. And in some ways, that obsessive rereading helps with revision. It really causes me to be extra tuned into the musicality of language and the rhythm of it. I read things in my mind. When I'm practicing my poetry and I'm revising, I read things out loud and hear it. But as far as writing about OCD, it isn't anything I thought of doing until I was 35. It took me, you know, I wrote 3 other full-length collections before I thought of truly writing about myself.
I wonder, do you set aside time then to write like an exercise that you do each day with your writing and poetry? Or do you just decide that, you know, it strikes you in the moment where you sit down and work on a new collection?
Well, I think as poets, we're often taught, or we hear the message, that we wait for the muse to arrive.
Yeah.
And I think that poets could really benefit from the philosophy of novelists who just sit in the chair. And something that has kept me sitting in the chair and showing up for my own creativity and my own work is having a poetry community around me and having a poetry group that I'm sharing work with. Because for a while, in fact, I didn't, for a period of about 5 years, I wasn't writing at all. And I didn't have a poetry group at that time. And my friends started up a new group and I said, well, I'm not writing, but I'll join anyway. And all of a sudden you have a peer saying, when's your poem? You know, where's your poem?
You need
a poem for next Thursday. Exactly. So it's truly helpful. And if you show up for your work, then the muse will arrive.
Mm. The theme of guilt comes up in some of your poetry. Can you explain a little bit more about such feelings of guilt?
I think that probably just comes from OCD. And it's something where you have a feeling of guilt that just shows up out of nowhere, and then your mind responds to that sensation in your body and says, what have I done? You know, I say this in one of the poems in my book, what have you done? And I don't think I could ever come up with the answer. When I was a child, I had these terrible dreams that I had murdered someone. And again, I think it goes back to that Judith Rapoport book and that case study where you start to think, am I sure I know what I've done? And OCD for many years was known as scrupulosity. So really, really wanting to be perfect and to be good and worrying about sinning too much. And so I think that really showed itself for me in my OCD as well.
Poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman of Madison focuses her new collection on her journey with obsessive compulsive disorder from childhood to adulthood. It's called Exploding Head, and we're discussing these poems. Be part of the discussion at any point. You can call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book of evocative prose poetry. It chronicles a childhood onset and an adult journey through obsessive-compulsive disorder, a mental health condition characterized by obsessions and compulsions that interfere with life, with living. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman's new collection is called Exploding Head. Cynthia, can you read a poem for us, Exploding Head Syndrome, and if you could share that poem with us?
Sure. Exploding Head Syndrome. You are finally an adult, living with roommates in a house with a rickety banister and soft spots in the floor when your head begins exploding at night. First, a swish like a heavy wing dragging across the air, and then the door slams. Where does one life end and another begin? When you were a child, your thumb or your mother's thumb was slammed in the car door. One of you felt the pain, one of you the guilt. But you cannot remember which was which. You often dreamed of a guilt so grave you fell to your knees in the garden. Tadpoles shuddered in their leafy beds. What have you done? Once, a red balloon sailed to the ceiling of a warehouse, and though the ribbon slipped from your or your sister's fingers, you cannot remember which. You know the empty hand. You are always running from the shadow that chases you. In the forest at night, an owl screams a womanly, murderous scream. Neighbors call the police. You and your sister and your mother set out with the dog and a flashlight and find nothing.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing that. Why did you choose this poem to share the title of your book?
It's funny because as I look at this collection, Exploding Head Syndrome, the title of this book, Exploding Head, is really the only syndrome or disorder that's diagnosed by name in the book. I don't say obsessive compulsive disorder anywhere in the poems themselves, but Exploding Head seemed to me like it encapsulated that feeling of your head is so packed full and it's so busy with these obsessions and these mental compulsions. It just felt to me like it summarized the experience of OCD in a way.
You describe these poems as memoir in prose poems. Have you always written in prose?
I wrote stories when I was little and essays when I was a little older. And at some point I decided I'm a poet. You know, poems have line breaks. Poems are written in form, et cetera.
They rhyme.
And, right. Well, mine don't.
But yes, no.
they often do rhyme. So I think that I finally, as the years went on as a poet, fell back into the prose form. And I have a poem in the book called The Music of Language. Is opening up for you. The music of language is clamping down hard. And it's about my experience with OCD forcing me to rip onto little patterns of things that people say that have a certain number of syllables. They'll just hear, oh, that has six syllables. And that works if I look at the window pane and I count the four sides of the window and I draw an X through the middle. And I have this, you know, compulsion to repeat these phrases based on their musicality. And I think that that caused me as a young child to pay attention to language. And so in a way, OCD, I think, has given me the gift of poetry.
The book, it being written using the personal pronoun you and not I, why do you choose to use you?
I have a poem in the beginning of the book that says, "You are not you again today." And I think that that is kind of summarizing this sense that there's the OCD reality that we live in, which is kind of the not you. It's not truly who I am. It's a big part of me, but it's not my identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of my identity. And then there's the you, the true me who lives in the world. And I think also you is a way of creating a distance between myself and the subject. And when I first started writing these poems, it was just a more comfortable place for me to talk about, in a way, someone else and this other part of me that I had never shared before.
You mentioned religion and growing up in a spiritual community. And when I think about religion as well, there are rituals in religious services, a lot of rituals. How does that aspect affect living with OCD in your poetry?
You're right. There are a lot of rituals associated with religion. And I don't think that my upbringing was religious enough to have brought a lot of those rituals into the home.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember, of course, praying every night and saying, if I die before I wake, etc. And I think that that's probably a part of what brought the angel into my room as well. This idea that you spend the night before you go to bed connecting with a spiritual entity and connecting with God or an angel or whatever my concept was at the time.
Well, how did that make you feel, that connection before trying to fall asleep? Was that helpful or harmful?
I think it was harmful. It was definitely terrifying. I don't, mm-hmm. you know, that prayer that we say, it really calls to mind the idea that you might die before you wake up the next morning. You know, mm-hmm. I was a kid. I was already pretty in tune with poetry and language and the meaning of things. And that didn't get past me. That wasn't just something I recited. I felt that in my soul every night that I might die. And so I think that, again, I think that probably, you know, conjured the angel in my mind in some way, that I was making a connection to something spiritual that was scary.
New poetry book, Exploding Head. We're talking with Madison Bay's poet, Cynthia Marie Hoffman. You can join in with your questions. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The book guides the reader through a series of thoughts and perspectives, as well as experiences. And one poem is titled, This Is All True, and includes like this list of experiences that are written almost like instructions. What is this poem about?
So This Is All True is kind of, you're right, instructions. Instructions for Cynthia Marie Hoffman's OCD. It's a list of all the things, or some of the things, that were compulsions or concerns for me. And I think that this poem in particular, some of the lines are, if your foot dangles off the edge of the bed, a metal blade rises from the floor and slices it off. How do you know you haven't murdered someone accidentally? Look directly at the sun, touch your eyeball once a day. These are all kind of, you know, OCD rules that are made up when I was a child. And I think that this poem kind of says, when I say this is an OCD memoir in prose poetry, or this is an OCD poem, I've been saying that and kind of announcing it as my elevator pitch for this book, imagining that that creates automatically a rich, full understanding in others of what an OCD poem might be. But I'm learning the more, or I'm reminded the more that I talk about this book, that there's a great misunderstanding about what encompasses OCD, what OCD can possibly be. You know, as Jenny said earlier, it manifests itself so differently in different people. So people might not know that for me, an OCD poem means violence, terror.
Hmm. You write how blinking is very powerful, and you say blinking seven times memorizes the faces of the people you love. You write about blinking more in the beginning, in the childhood section. Does blinking become less powerful as the book progresses?
It does. And in fact, that was probably the one thing that I would say was a visible external OCD compulsion, where I have another poem in the book called The Face Has Seven Holes that has kind of instructions for drawing a star on people's faces by blinking on their eyes and their mouth and their ears. And that was something that I used to do when I was a child. So you would be talking to me and I would be drawing a star on your face, blinking seven times. And people noticed. And one time in school when I was little, we were playing volleyball and I got hit in the face by the ball, volleyball. Not good with ball sports. And my eyes swelled up and I went to the nurse and someone said, you know, your eye is swollen. Is that why you're blinking so much? And I thought, oh, yes, people are noticing this. That was the first time that I was aware that my compulsion was visible to others. And I knew I didn't want other people to know. So I worked really hard at replacing that compulsion with something else, patterning or counting internally in order to hide.
Let's talk about the counting. And I'm just wondering, you know, counting, it comes up. You write, such a waste, hours lost to counting the window panes in this room. Can you explain the issues with counting and how you write about it in the poem?
Yeah, I also have another poem called It Starts that talks about introducing the concept of counting when I was a child. And I always would look at the window and count the four sides of the window. So right, left, top, bottom. And if you kind of draw that pattern on the window, right, left, top, bottom, it makes a four. And for some reason, OCD makes up its own rules. So four is good. You know, some things feel right, some things are wrong. And four is a good number for me. And so it just feels, when you're worried about something, OCD comes in with a compulsion to say, this is how you settle your fears. This compulsion is a ritualistic kind of settling for you. It helps with the anxiety. But over the years, the compulsions become the problem. You know, it's not even so much the fear, but and the anxiety, it's the fact that I'm counting all the time. What could I accomplish if I wasn't doing that?
There's a line, like there's a sort of grace in it, after all, counting yourself lucky to be alive. It sounds like you give a little bit of reprieve in that moment, allowance for the counting.
I think so, because this has been something that I dealt with on my own for so long. I learned to sort of adjust to it and keep it as a part of myself that I was able to see some good in. You know, OCD has made me who I am. It's affected my creativity in positive ways. I see and hear things because of OCD that I wouldn't see and hear if I didn't have it.
Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman's collection of poems is a glimpse inside the inner world of a life with obsessive compulsive disorder. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a Madison poet's deeply personal and decades-long struggle with obsessive-compulsive disorder, where a person gets caught in a cycle of obsessions and compulsions. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cynthia Marie Hoffman's new collection of poetry is called Exploding Head. Toward the end of your collection, you have a poem. It's titled A Great Many Things. Can you read this poem for us?
Sure. A Great Many Things. In the bath, a galaxy of bubbles collapses in a weightless, glittering mound, marking the end of another day in which you are not dead. Your body and all its invisible particles stitched tightly together sink deeper into this warm, white cradle, weary from the rattling of your own mind. At dusk, walking through the field, you picked a feather from the grass and ran its shimmering vein between your knuckles. You wanted to see how it was held together by peeling apart its hooks and barbs. There was a hush about it, the swish of hands releasing their grasp. You saw how easily the delicate design of the world can be undone. But for now, you are safe in this watery embrace. Each alternate universe bursts around you one by one, releasing a held breath. A great many things will happen to you, but none of the things you're afraid of. It was the wind in your hair, the red-winged birds embroidering the blue sky. That has been your life.
There's this exhale after reading that poem, like, oh, okay. You know, with the safe in this watery embrace, there's a more peaceful tone than some of the poems that came before. What do you think elicits this feeling of safety?
For me, actually, this feeling of safety and this tone that you referred to is something that I discovered over the course of writing the book, and in fact, assembling the book. It was late in the years that I spent writing these poems that I thought, let me just try it in chronological order. Let me just put all the childhood poems first and the later poems later and see how it reads. And when I sat down and read my own work that way and looked at my own life, I found that the childhood years were very scary, very lonely. And the later years, the later poems, I was naturally adopting a tone of self-compassion. I had learned to care for myself, to reassure myself that, hey, I'm safe. All these things that I've worried about, those are not the things that have happened. That was not your life. Even though you spent many hours and days and years over the course of your life imagining horrible things happening, that was just in your mind. You're truly safe. And so that's sort of something that I discovered and found other ways of self-care. Like, for example, this poem takes place in the bathtub, right? A bubble bath. What, you know, it's this nice, warm water. And thinking of just, you know, where can you find places in your own life where you feel safe and protected?
Hmm. Let's go to Jason in Janesville. Jason, hi.
Yes, I have a question. When you noticed your OCD, or even your parents or adults noticed your OCD was kind of an issue or kind of rearing its head through, did they try to put you on medication or try to, were you able to see this, solve this issue naturally?
Jason, thank you. Yeah, Cynthia.
That's a great question, Jason. My personal story, and I can't speak for others or make recommendations, of course, but I can only speak to my own lived experience. I would say it was more natural as far as the OCD. Cognitive behavioral therapy is something that I had sought for depression and anxiety. And that, even though it wasn't targeted specifically for OCD, it helped me make peace with my thoughts and remember that as long as I don't react to the thoughts, as long as I recognize that the thoughts are just thoughts and they can't harm me, it's not reality. That was the way that I naturally found a safe space for myself with OCD. I did seek medication for anxiety and depression, and those are all things that kind of come along with OCD. I think we're there because of the presence of OCD. So targeting OCD as the base, I think, is what ultimately helped me feel better.
How has motherhood influenced your poetry?
Well, I think that motherhood is such a big part of my life. I have a child. They're 14 years old now, teenager. But over the course of this book, they were really little, you know, a toddler. And as far as OCD, that child that I was suddenly responsible for kind of just clicked right into place with all my other OCD worries. It was yet another person that I loved deeply that OCD made me worry about losing. And so my child does appear quite a bit in the book. And motherhood, I think, is impossible not to write about because it's part of my identity.
So where does your poetry take you next? Where, you know, after this collection, and we think about those last words in the bubble bath, you know, where does your poetry go next?
Well, I'm in that place of figuring out what's next. I tend to write, and I think also because of OCD, I have kind of an obsessive personality, and I love to think of crafting a book rather than poem by poem. So I love what we would call in the poetry world project books. You know, this book is on a theme. My previous three books were all on their own theme. I enjoy the act of building a world. So I'm kind of feeling around for the next obsession. I'm writing a little bit about climate change, a little bit more about being the mother of a teenager, and we'll see where that takes me.
What are your suggestions, advice for other poets or people who are in other artistic pursuits as they also navigate an anxiety disorder?
I think just, again, self-compassion and recognizing, you know, I'm a perfectionist, and it wasn't even until recently finding more of an OCD community that I recognized perfectionism as a kind of symptom of OCD. I just thought, oh, I'm a perfectionist. So recognizing that and allowing yourself to just remember that life is messy, make a mess, you know, just allow yourself to be creative and make mistakes and experiment.
Life is messy and experiment. And yet, I wonder, does poetry create some order for you?
Oh, it absolutely does. Even within the prose poem, which is kind of a disordered order, a prose poem, for those who might not know, is just a paragraph. Mm-hmm. It looks like a little piece of prose, you know, just like reading a memoir. And even in that space, I love the structure of the sentence, the musicality of how it builds and then falls. And it is a very lovely, orchestrated space in which to express yourself.
Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing your works.
Thank you for having me this morning, Kate.
Cynthia Marie Hoffman is a poet and author in Madison. Her new poetry collection is called Exploding Head. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.